This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Pope Francis has endorsed same-sex civil unions for the first time, as Pope Reuters' Joe Davies has that story.
Pope Francis has said that homosexuals should be protected by civil union laws in some of the clearest language he's used on gay rights. His comments came in a new film released on Wednesday. He says, quote, homosexual people have a right to be in a family. He went on, they are children of God and have a right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or be made miserable over it. What we have to create is a civil union law. That way they are legally covered. I stood up for that.
Nigeria's biggest city, Lagos, and several states are under curfews as unrest rooted in anti-police protests broke out again following a day of violence, including the shooting of civilians by security forces. Armed police trying to enforce a round-the-clock curfew in the commercial capital, setting up checkpoints, but groups of young men blocked a number of major roads with overturned traffic signs, tree branches, and rocks. Negotiations on a COVID-19 relief bill are inching forward, but it is clear the window for action before the November 3rd elections, U.S. elections, is closing, and the issue will be tossed to a post-election lame duck session of the U.S. Congress. The only thing that seems certain beyond that is uncertainty, with Capitol Hill veterans cautioning against expecting a quick and smooth resolution for an aid package that has tied Washington in knots for a matter of months. Again, negotiations on a COVID-19 relief bill are, in fact, inching forward, but for action before the November 3rd election closing. This is VOA News. The Trump administration's Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, says Russia and Iran have both obtained U.S. voter information and taken actions to influence public opinion ahead of the November 3rd election. Ratcliffe says Iran sent spoofed emails to Americans designed to intimidate voters and cite unrest and damage U.S. President Donald Trump. As federal health officials say, the nation is seeing a distressing rise in COVID-19 cases. President Trump's predecessor is calling out his handling of the pandemic.
We literally left this White House a pandemic playbook that would have shown them how to respond before the virus reached our shores. They probably used it to, prop up a wobbly table somewhere. We don't know where that playbook went.
And that is former U.S. President Barack Obama. The World Health Organization says that Europe again has recorded a new high in the weekly number of coronavirus cases.
Police open fire as protesters continue to demonstrate against police brutality in Nigeria. Amnesty International said late Tuesday there was credible but disturbing evidence that security forces had fatally shot protesters who were demonstrating against police despite a new curfew being imposed. One protester has told the Associated Press that his brother was shot and killed in the previous day's demonstrations and that he himself had taken a bullet in the leg. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
U.S. prosecutors say Purdue Pharma agreed to plead guilty to criminal charges over the handling of its addictive prescription opioid OxyContin. The deal effectively sidesteps paying billions of dollars in penalties and stops short of criminally charging its executives or wealthy Sackler family owners. The U.S. State Department has approved the potential sale of three weapon systems to Taiwan, including sensors, missiles, and artillery that could have a total value of $1.8 billion. Reuters reported last week that the White House was moving forward with five separate sales of sophisticated military equipment to Taiwan with a total value of around $5 billion. Britain and the European Union have agreed to resume talks on reaching a trade deal to govern their future relations, setting out a new set of organizing principles for intensified talks to begin on Thursday. They will prioritize their duty of care to individuals and negotiating teams on both sides and make appropriate decisions. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There were more disturbances Wednesday in Lagos and other Nigerian cities despite a 24-hour curfew.
The security agents couldn't use water or even whips to disperse people. They used live ammunition that killed plenty.
Nigerians in Ghana protest in support of ENSAR's movement. A UN mediator says Libya's warring parties have made positive moves towards peace. African diaspora looks to flex political muscle in U.S. elections. And the party of Uganda's Bobi Wine wins a court victory.
We are the people power. And we are the next ruling party of the Republic of Uganda.
And Harare's water shortages force a community to use graveyard wells. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There were more disturbances Wednesday in Lagos and other Nigerian cities despite a 24-hour curfew to slow down anti-police brutality protests and violence. Reports late Wednesday say young protesters set up roadblocks and lit fires in Lagos. Nigerian protesters have accused the military of opening fire on them on Tuesday in the commercial capital Lagos as they defied a curfew to demand reforms. Nigeria's military has denied that the uniformed men who appeared in social media posts to fire on the unarmed protesters were their troops. Rights groups have expressed alarm at unconfirmed reports that a number of protesters were killed and wounded. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
25-year-old Dominic Alonge left work early after Lagos authorities announced an impromptu curfew that began at 4 p.m. local time on Tuesday. He spent hours in traffic but couldn't make it through roadblocks mounted by protesters. He then walked until he arrived at the Lekki toll gate and decided to join the protests. Alonge says that around 7 p.m., security men in military uniforms descended on the crowd and opened fire after disabling CCTV cameras and streetlights, he says.
They fired rounds and rounds of live ammunition in the guise of dispersing protesters. The security agents couldn't use water or even whips to disperse people. They used live ammunition that killed plenty.
Other eyewitnesses say many protesters were killed during the shooting and many more gravely injured. However, Lagos officials say only one person has died, with others receiving treatment at hospitals in Lagos State. State Governor Babajide Sanwo-Olu visited injured protesters on Wednesday morning and urged Lagos citizens to remain calm. But human rights organizations are blaming the government for the shooting. Ariya Dare is the leader of one such group, the Nigeria Center for Liberty.
The shooting of peaceful protesters by men of the Nigerian army, including other security agencies, all but not in a barbaric act carried out by rogue soldiers, elements sent by the Nigerian government with the connivance of the Lagos State government to unleash terror on peaceful protesters.
Both Lagos authorities and the Nigerian army have denied ordering the shooting. On Wednesday, hours after the shooting, angry youths launched reprisal attacks all over the state, burning and damaging many state-owned establishments, including media houses believed to be influenced by the government. The home of the governor's mother was also targeted and razed to the ground. Ariyo says violence is likely to escalate.
These protests cannot end with the way and manner the government has handled this protest. There is no way these protests will end in this format. Even when the curfew is over, Nigerians will still continue these protests.
Rights activists have accused Nigerian authorities in the past of using excessive force against citizens. Amnesty International has been investigating alleged rights violations by Nigerian forces for many years. But the organization's country director, Osai Ujigo, says the perpetrators remain emboldened.
Our first report focusing specifically on the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, SARS, was done in 2016. And in that report, we gave specific recommendations that needed to happen, one of which was prosecuting violating officers. The second was entrenching the Police Service Commission in order for them to do their job. But sadly, things continued. We continued to receive cases and we opened up even further research into this area.
As tensions mount across Nigeria, the U.S. consulate in Lagos was shut down Tuesday, and the State Department warned Americans in Nigeria to be careful. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigerians in Ghana are joining growing diaspora protests against police brutality in the West African nation, spurred on by events on Tuesday night in Lagos, where soldiers allegedly opened fire on protesters. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Across the world, people are expressing outrage over the events in Lagos late Tuesday. On Tuesday, after Lagos state authorities announced a 24-hour curfew, eyewitnesses said soldiers opened fire on demonstrators at Lekki Toll Plaza, with casualties reported. Nigeria's army denied it was responsible for deaths at the scene, branding stories that blame soldiers for the casualties as fake news. Meanwhile, what started out as a movement to end a notorious police unit has now evolved into demands for widespread reform in Nigeria. In Accra on Wednesday, about 150 people gathered outside the Nigerian High Commission. Most were from Nigeria, but they were supported by a handful of Ghanaian compatriots. Franklin Digbe, a Ghanaian DJ, said he was there because the two nations were intertwined in many aspects, especially with entertainment. He said what was happening in Nigeria was atrocious and called for solidarity.
It's very necessary because we're here when we saw the George Floyd thing happen. And it was like, yeah, okay, Black Lives Matter. And this was something that we saw and we had solidarity across the world for. So if you're in Ghana and you're seeing this happening in Nigeria, then we should all come together as people.
Also at the protest was Nigerian citizen Andohemba Oria. He said he hoped protests would lead to real change in his country.
If I was in Lagos yesterday, I would be at the protest ground because I'm passionate about my country. I hate it when people talk bad about Nigeria. If the Nigerian government is good, 50% of Nigerians living in every part of the world will go back home and settle back home and do legitimate business.
There have been protests and candlelit vigils across the world in the past week, including in Canada, the United Kingdom, the US, Egypt, Australia and South Africa. Damiola Odufua in Lagos said it was more important than ever to see global solidarity as Nigeria's largest city is now under curfew. The activist is one of the founding members of the Feminist Coalition, a Nigerian organisation working to get legal help, funding and supplies to protesters across Nigeria. She wanted global bodies to also speak out for Nigerian protesters and believed international pressure would help Nigerians exercise their constitutional rights.
We are united in this fight against police brutality and against bad governors. All we want is good leadership. And that has been really touching to see people come out and stand up for us. And we pray that tomorrow, while we are under some form of curfew where our internet is kind of slowing down, that people speak up for us.
As the protest has evolved, the hashtag #EndBadGovernance has also trended on social media. The protest is backed by global celebrities such as Twitter founder Jack Dorsey, singing star Beyonce, and Nigerian entertainers Davido and Wizkid. US presidential candidate Joe Biden and former US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton criticized the state response to the demonstrations on Tuesday, with Clinton tweeting that Nigeria's president and army should stop killing young NSARS protesters. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
In Uganda, the opposition National Unity Platform Party, or NUP, has won a landslide court victory that challenges the legality of the party. Party leader Rabo Chakulain, also known as Bobby Wine, said after the judgment that the court verdict is a clear demonstration of confidence and a big step toward an eventual victory in the 2021 presidential election. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala.
In dismissing the petition, High Court Judge Musa Sekana said the applicants do not follow proper legal procedures. He said the applicants should have filed the case before June 6, 2019. The applicants had challenged Chagrani and other party leaders for changing the party name from formerly National Unity Reconciliation and Development Party, or NURP, to National Unity Platform, or NUP, without their consent. They also allege that party founding president Moses Tshibalama legally transferred the party leadership to Mr. Kyagulanyi and others. While addressing party supporters in Kampala on Wednesday, Kyagulanyi welcomed the court's decision and described the case as bogus.
We are the National Unity Platform. We are people power. And we are the next ruling party of the Republic of Uganda.
However, Kyagulanyi, who is also a popular musician, said the case had some impact on party followers.
Now we can see that this case was brought to cut our speed. This case was brought up to vulgarize us as the National Unity Platform. This case was brought to antagonize us. And in my opinion, our detractors in many ways achieved their intentions. We lost more than 50 candidates who were not sure whether or not the legality of the National Unity Platform will be upheld.
Sarah Birete, executive director of the NGO Center for Constitutional Governance, which promotes constitutional literacy across East Africa, applauded the court ruling.
We are glad that these cases are out of the way as we go into presidential nominations. And although the party members and leadership have lost time, we hope that they are able to catch up and put their act together and prepare for the presidential nominations as well as the major campaigns leading into next elections.
Yasin Sekamate, a security and political analyst, says NUP should be ready to face such obstacles as the party head into the 2021 presidential election campaign.
It is very okay for NUP to jubilate. I think it's a big achievement on their side. They have been on many occasions trying to criticize the courts and saying that the courts works in the armpits of the government. And I think with this kind of decision, it is clear that the courts can stand independent and give a judgment that based on reality, on the facts.
Meanwhile, Bobi Wine's party says they lost over 7 million signatures when security forces raided their offices about 2 weeks ago. Signatures are some of the requirements for the nomination for the presidency. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 22nd. A United Nations mediator reports positive developments after 2 days of face-to-face peace talks involving military leaders from Libya's warring parties. A fourth round of the Libyan Joint Military Commission aimed at achieving a permanent ceasefire is taking place in Geneva this week. Lisa Schlein reports.
The head of the UN support mission in Libya, Stephanie Williams, says the two sides have reached agreements on several important issues which directly impact the lives and welfare of the Libyan people. Williams says the Libyan delegations have agreed to open land routes that connect all the regions and cities of Libya and to resume flights throughout the country. She says they have agreed to stop the use of inflammatory language and to hold accountable those who use hate speech on social media to incite violence. She says Libya's military leaders also have agreed to support the current calm in the country and to avoid any military escalation. Williams says she believes these agreements will stick because they are Libyan-owned solutions.
And I think that is really the most optimistic and positive development that I have seen. After all, it's their country, and Libya is for Libyans. And that is why I continue to be very optimistic that the parties here are going to reach a more lasting and permanent ceasefire.
Libya has been in a state of turmoil since former dictator Muammar Gaddafi was killed in 2011. A violent nationwide power struggle has been ongoing between two rival governments, the internationally recognized government in the capital Tripoli and the Benghazi-based Libya National Army headed by renegade commander Khalifa Haftar. Fighting has died down in recent months under international pressure. While expressing optimism about the talks, Williams says she sees many difficulties ahead as the parties dig into thornier issues of the agreements.
We are, in a sense, in a bit of a race against time here because of the conditions in the country and, frankly, because of the degree of flagrant foreign intervention and blatant violations of the arms embargo.
Turkey is a main supporter of the UN-recognized government in Tripoli. Russia and the United Arab Emirates are among other countries allied with Haftar's forces. All have come under criticism for violating the UN arms embargo and fueling Libya's destructive, chaotic civil war. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
2 years after the inauguration of the Central African Republic's Special Criminal Court, known as SCC, many alleged perpetrators of human rights violations and abuses are still free, according to a new report by Amnesty International. Amnesty spokesperson Alice Bennett spoke to Ricky Stryak about the challenges and delays that many residents in the country are facing while they seek justice for crimes, some of which were committed almost two decades ago.
Even though there's been investigations and trials that have started these past few years, it remains quite weak compared to the scale of the crimes that have happened in the past two decades and the fact that victims have been waiting for so long. So we can't say that alleged perpetrators will be working free, but what we can say is that so far, two decades after those crimes have happened, a lot of those most responsible are still working free.
What about the challenge of finding or recruiting international judges?
The Special Criminal Court in the Central African Republic is a hybrid court, meaning that it's supported by the UN, and half of the judges are from CAR and half of the judges are international, so from outside of CAR. And so the judges from CAR have been recruited and appointed, so that's working okay. What's the main challenge is to find international judges to come and join those judges from CAR to examine those cases. One of the reasons for that is that those judges must be, their applications must be submitted by states that are ready to second them. So we need Francophone states that are willing to send judges to contribute to this important tribunal in CAR, and those applications are not coming in. Some states have done so, and France was one of them, Burkina Faso was one of them. Unfortunately, not enough states are doing it.
Were there efforts made to reconcile what is often a dichotomy in some of these countries between the quote-unquote formal or imported justice system and the traditional justice system?
What's really interesting with the situation in the Central African Republic is that there is a strong, strong demand from people in CAR to justice in the sense of criminal trials. And that has been so for quite a long time, and it has come back again and again. For instance, in the 2015 Bangui Forum, that was one of the calls that were made by leaders of the civil society and others. We said really that one of their main calls is that they wanted to fight against impunity to be one of the priorities, and they wanted to have no immunities or no amnesties given to the alleged perpetrators. Whether it be the ordinary court or the special criminal court is a secondary question, as long as those people are brought to court.
That was Alice Bennett, spokesperson for Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. African diaspora organizers say the U.S. 2020 election is drawing more African-born immigrants eligible to vote. But some argue that they are not organized enough to constitute a voting bloc relative to other immigrant communities in the U.S. Salem Solomon reports.
The African diaspora in the United States is mobilizing voter drives as organizers believe 2020 is a time for these voters to flex their political muscles as never before. Nika Achapu is the founder of the African Public Affairs Committee, a nonpartisan political organization that advocates policies for the empowerment of the African diaspora.
Our goal is to empower people into learning that they have a voice, they have a say in the policies, in the laws that are actually brought forth and are affecting us as Africans living in this country.
According to the latest U.S. Census figures, in 2018, there were over 2 million foreign-born Africans in the country. Overall, 50.6% of immigrants are naturalized citizens, and 94.4% are 18 years old or older and likely have voting rights. But the diverse and dispersed nature of the population in the U.S. makes it hard for African voters to organize, although there are concentrated population centers in several cities, including Minneapolis, Washington, D.C., Houston, and New York City. The African diaspora does not speak with a single voice. There are no definitive surveys as to the political leanings of African diaspora, says John Campbell, a senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C.
They are not big enough or organized enough to constitute a voting bloc, unlike some other ethnic identities in the United States.
But organizers say concerns of U.S. voters of African descent aren't much different than the U.S. population at large, the economy, education, healthcare, and security. Because many African immigrants work in frontline roles, the COVID-19 response is a major concern.
A lot of our African diaspora members are in the trenches and working, whether it's in the medical field, whether it's in transporting people, whether it's bagging groceries. We are pretty much everywhere.
And the power of voters from the African diaspora appears to be growing. Between 2010 and 2018, the sub-Saharan Africa population in the U.S. increased by 52%. On a national level, several African politicians have made waves. In 2018, Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota became the first Somali American elected to Congress, and Representative Joe Neguse of Colorado, born in the U.S. to Eritrean parents, became the first person of Eritrean origin elected to Congress. A study by the Pew Research Center showed that, contrary to stereotypes, African immigrants to the U.S. on average are more likely to be college educated and employed than the population at large. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabwe's severe water shortages have forced one desperate community near the capital, Harare, to draw water from a graveyard. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, health experts are warning about the dangers of drinking contaminated water.
Those are residents of the Harare suburb of Hopley collecting water at the break of dawn in an unexpected and taboo place, the graveyard. In Zimbabwean culture, the dead are sacred and their resting places should not be disturbed, especially from dusk to dawn. But 25-year-old Wimbai Sanyama says severe water shortages have forced her and her neighbors to draw water from open sources surrounded by graves. We are no longer afraid because we have no water, says Sanyama. If we are afraid, where do we get water for laundry and other chores? Sanyama blames politicians for making false promises about solving the water shortages, saying once they are elected, they do nothing. Dr. Alex Kasasira, the head of World Health Organization in Zimbabwe, warns that drinking water from a well in a graveyard risks exposure to diseases such as typhoid fever and cholera.
People drinking water from an open source that is likely to be contaminated could suffer from, you know, waterborne diseases. We have very many waterborne diseases, and this can cause a lot of suffering and death. The normal epidemic diseases, diarrheal diseases, typhoid, cholera, we know that also different types of neglected tropical diseases. So all these are a big concern to me.
But Hopley residents say they have little choice. Water shortages are common, they say, and getting worse, despite promises by officials each election to solve the problem. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And that's it for this Thursday, October 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good day.